You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The Estado León, a soccer or football stadium in the central Mexican state of Guanajuato. Today, we're taking you far from Los Angeles, but not far from Angelinos. There's more than 1,000 of them right here. They flew 1,500 miles to León to watch Los Angeles Football Club, LAFC, compete. This is the first leg of the CONCACAF Champions League tournament. That's where the top soccer clubs in North America, Central America, and the Caribbean face off. The game you're hearing in León took place last week, and tomorrow night, LAFC and the powerful Mexican team Club León will face off for a second time at Banc of California Stadium here in Los Angeles. Reporter Ryan Wallerson traveled with LAFC supporters to the game in Mexico, and he tells us about who those fans are and how they were received south of the border.
These are people who proudly call themselves supporters as opposed to mere fans. That means that they'll schedule their life around the team. They'll travel anywhere. There are several LAFC supporter groups. I was embedded with two of them, known as the Expo Originals and the Tigers, but all of the groups together are collectively known as the 3252. So it was game day, the day when LAFC supporters usually have a tailgate next to the stadium hours before the match. And in this case, all of the supporter groups came together in a parking lot of a chicken wing restaurant a few blocks from Estadio León, and the crowd grew to engulf the plaza.
Easily one of the greatest tailgates in Los Angeles Football Club history. The team went to one bar, took over the bar across the street, and ended up spilling into the middle and established a third location with several boxes of beers in the parking lot. There were León fans that were either there with LAFC fans or walked up because they were on site for the match, interested in what was going on. I can definitely confirm jerseys being exchanged. I can confirm hats being exchanged. Supporters of both teams at the same bar, coexisting benignly. The tailgate ended around sunset, just as the last of the light is disappearing from the sky. And then it was time for this mass of people to march to Estadio León together as a group, accompanied by León police walking beside them and on horseback. Tigers supporter group leader Josh Lee addressed his people.
We are about to be police escorted to the stadium right now. The most important thing is that we stay together.
Security for the visiting team's fans is a big deal. Josh makes sure no individual LAFC supporter wanders around alone.
When we get to the stadium, there will be a bathroom directly behind our section. I'm going to make a rule right now that you can only go to the bathroom with three people with you at all times, right? There needs to be a group of three.
And then the march began in the veil of night.
But it took a long time, over an hour. The route was planned out by the León police, so the march happened on the side streets.
There were turns that had to be made, curves that had to be maneuvered. The supporters were supposed to be into the stadium 2 hours before the match began, but that didn't happen. So they walk in around the same time the León supporters are walking in. The León fans and supporters are aware of their presence. I think the stadium kept its energy levels really high. The entire stadium was singing. There was fireworks, there were smoke bombs, there was a huge amount of smoke that kind of sat over the stadium for a while. Yeah, you know, once the game started, the ball's kicked, it becomes about X's and O's and football ideas. And honestly, León and LAFC play in a very similar way, very pressing format where they're trying to get forward and are always looking to score. León was able to do that much more efficiently and with a lot more success than LAFC. LAFC was defending a lot.
The day before the match, I'd spoken to a León supporter named Juan Brujas about LAFC's best player and captain, Carlos Vela, the most famous and talented Mexican player in the tournament. He said while it's a special occasion to have Vela playing in his home stadium, he still wants his own team to win. In fact, he predicted that Vela wouldn't score a goal at all. And that was a prediction that came true. LAFC fell behind 2-0, but in their section of the stadium, surrounded by a chain-link fence, the LAFC supporters were not giving up.
Back at home, everybody knows us at the Banc of California Stadium in downtown LA because the 3252 is there rocking the North End with their flags and their drums.
This is Patrick Aviles, supporter relations at LAFC.
But here, no flags, no drums allowed, no belt buckles.
Instead of drums, they improvised with cups and plastic chairs. After the game was over, there was a really nice moment between the fans where the applause that the Leon supporters were giving was going toward the 3252, who had to stay in the stadium for about 20 minutes to half an hour to allow the Leon fans to clear out.
So coming out here this strong is showing Mexico, but not only Mexico, but the world, that we're the real deal.
This is 3252 president Jimmy Lopez.
We travel everywhere. We don't just travel to Portland or New York. It's like, no, this is international. We care about our community, our culture, and our team so much that if we can make it, we're here.
So now the game shifts back here to LA, and these same two teams play at Banc of California Stadium tomorrow night, with LAFC trying to come back from this two-goal deficit. At the Banc, I've seen LAFC score three goals many times. I've seen them pitch many shutouts. If they can play their game and be the team on the attacking foot, I think they do have a chance to turn it around. Obviously, it's a tall task, but we'll see. For KCRW, I'm Ryan Wallerson.
The piece was produced, by the way, by KCRW's Bob Carlson. And you can see that return match tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Banc of California Stadium. Coming up on this program, LA's new city council president is looking for a balanced approach to dealing with the city's homelessness crisis. You're going to hear from her next on KCRW's Greater LA. You're back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. There's a new president of the Los Angeles City Council.
Colleagues, thank you. It's an honor to stand here before all of you as your council president and the first Latina elected to the council presidency in 170 years of U.S. government.
That is Nuri Martinez. She grew up in Pacoima, the daughter of a dishwasher and a factory worker from Zacatecas, Mexico. In 2009, she won a seat on the L.A. School Board, and 4 years later, she was elected to the L.A. City Council. She represents Council District 6, which includes North Hollywood, Van Nuys, up to Arleta, and Sun Valley. And L.A.'s Council President Martinez joins us right now. Council member, welcome. Congratulations to you.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you for having me on your program.
You bet. You are now the president of the City Council, so give us a quick civics lesson. What are the powers of the council presidency?
Well, most importantly, it's chairing the meetings every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday in council, but it's also setting the agenda in terms of what items come before the council, making sure that things are moving along in committees and making sure departments are responding to committees and committee chairs so that the business of the city council can be more effective. But also, I serve with 14 other members, so it's also making sure that their priorities and how they deliver services to their districts also make it on the council, and then I'm supporting that as well.
Sounds a lot like herding cats.
That's right? One way to put it.
Trying to get everyone moving in the same, at least in the same direction. I know you got to find consensus too as the president. And as I mentioned, I remember actually, I was working here at KCRW 2013, and you were first voted onto the council back then. At the time, the only woman of 15 mm-hmm. council members. Now there are two of you on the city council in the year 2020.
And by the way, we're both from the same area. We both grew up in the northeast San Fernando Valley. Me and Ms. Rodriguez, who also represents Council District 7 to the northeast side of my district, we both went to San Fernando High School. And so she's been great to work with. And we just got to, you know, help find a path for more women to get elected on this council.
And that's the question I want to ask you. Is the problem getting women to run, or is it getting women elected? Is it both?
You know what, it's not. I think the women are there. They're leading in their own communities, whether they're running businesses or they're running nonprofits or taking on controversial issues. The issue is that the pipeline, in order for them to prepare them and so that they can see themselves as future elected officials, that seems to be the issue. Women shouldn't wait till the last minute to file and run for these seats. We should have a map of all the open seats in the next 4 years, and we should have women ready to run in whether it's in the legislature, for Congress or city council, school board, water boards, whatever it might be, we should have a pool of women ready to go. Say this, you know, you should run for this seat. We should all be prepared to support you financially and put boots on the ground to make sure that she's successful and a viable candidate to be able to win.
How do you think it would change things in LA if there were more women on the council? Would we be a different city?
Yeah, I think so. I think women bring a different perspective when it comes to whether you're a mom or not. I think just women legislate differently. We try to compromise a lot of the times. I think we're just coalition builders by nature. I think if you heard my speech on January 14th, which was my official first city council meeting that I presided over, I talked about this family first agenda. What are we doing to prevent people from ending up on a sidewalk, living in a car, or ending up in a motel with their kids? I think that's what women, the perspective that women bring, is how do we put families first and making sure that we are doing everything humanly possible to track and house homeless families and making them a priority.
You and the city council were against SB 50. This is Senate Bill 50, that bill that would have allowed more dense development near transit. But how is LA going to be able to house all these people if we're not willing to get more dense housing in the city?
Well, the position of the city council was to oppose the bill. And I think that some of us, grapple with the fact that I know it's really hard to build in LA, but I have a hard time with sweeping land use authority coming down from the state legislature and deregulating the housing industry without any real guarantees that it's actually going to provide low income housing for communities that I represent. So that was my basic premise about not supporting SB 50. I think we can get there, but we also have to be and have a real honest conversation about NIMBYism in Los Angeles. Every single community and neighborhood is going to have to deal with the fact that we have to build more. And you can no longer build on the backs of communities of color. You know, in my district, no one ever says no to a project. I don't have 500 people turn out yelling at me and screaming at me not to build permanent supporting housing for unsheltered families. You know, I don't have that kind of constituency, but that constituency exists. And we've got to have a backbone to be able to say we need to build this type of housing everywhere because homelessness is affecting every single community in Los Angeles.
You have said, though, that we have to restore order in the streets when it comes to homelessness, that you want a balanced approach to homelessness. What do you mean by balanced approach?
You know, a lot of my constituents don't have, their backyard is not the ocean. It's not the beach. You know, they can't afford to take their families to a weekend at Disneyland. A lot of the times they play at our parks. They utilize our libraries. You know, is it fair for those children to walk over, you know, encampments, not being able to have accessible, clean, and safe sidewalks to be able to get to school every day? I think we all want that. But some of us have some encampments that are, you know, 100, 150 people deep. I mean, it's a real conversation. It's controversial as we're providing services and beds for our unhoused members. We also need to recognize that communities need to have accessible and clean sidewalks to be able to just live in their neighborhoods. We shouldn't have mountains of trash anywhere on our sidewalks. We should be able to roll up with sanitation and say, this is trash. We need to get rid of this so that people can actually access the sidewalk.
Speaking of cleaning up the sidewalks, last summer, Mayor Eric Garcetti created what are called care teams to clean up encampments. You've been critical of the care team work. What are your concerns there?
You know, my criticism is that if I see a pile of trash there one day and it's still there 2 weeks from today, that's my issue. I don't need another report from staff or another data or statistic to tell me why that pile of trash wasn't picked up. If the program is working, that pile of trash is going to be taken care of within 48 to 72 hours of someone reporting it.
So you're saying it's not doing enough.
District. Well, it's not going. If I'm driving through my neighborhoods and I reported a pile of trash and it's and you're telling me that the care team rolled up 2 days later, but yet it doesn't look any different, then how effective are we?
Do you think there's an issue with differentiating between trash and people's belongings on the street? Because that's been a criticism.
That, but I think at the beginning we were also, our sanitation staff was not making the call on what is trash and what isn't. And we were allowing members of LASA to, for example, make the call whether that stays or goes. And I think we need to come up with a plan. Like, who is going to make the call? If you see it, I mean, I understand people's belongings and you give people reasonable time to go through their stuff. But if there is a pile of trash, I can tell what a pile of trash looks like. That should be addressed and taken care of.
LASA is the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. They do a count every year. The latest count had more than 60,000 in LA County living on the streets and in shelters, more than 36,000 in the city of LA alone. Do you think the city's doing everything it can? Where are we failing?
You know, when we can't figure out how to house women and children, we've failed. Whether we're figuring out how to track women and children and families, we should be able to do that with the data that we collect. We should be able to know who's at the brink of homelessness and be able to address that so those families and children don't end up on a sidewalk. And until we do that, we're going to continue to keep bleeding because it's getting more and more expensive to live in Los Angeles. You know, a one-bedroom apartment in L.A. is $2,500. You know, for a family of four that's making less than $30,000 a year, that's just simply not enough. And so we've got to get serious about how we're going to prevent people from ending up on our streets. And I don't think we've done enough. And so I want to focus on making sure that children don't end up on motels. Every 30 days, they have to move out. Some of these kids are moving from one school to another because the motel voucher ran out. How is that conducive to raising kids in LA? It's not.
Your colleague on the city council, Mike Bonin, who represents the West Side, says there should be a cap on how much rent can go up.
I don't disagree, but you know you're going to have a debate with landlords. I mean, that is a debate we should have. I don't disagree with Mike. He introduced a motion last week that's going to go through the process, and we'll see what comes out of it.
You arguably have the biggest bully pulpit on the city council. You're the president. What are some other issues that you're looking at tackling as we wrap things up?
Primarily, like I said, it's got to be a focus on making sure that we're doing everything we can and working with this governor as he appropriates more than $750 million for, you know, homeless services. I want to ensure the city gets its fair share of those dollars. In meeting with him, I discussed my priority of women and children, and he was incredibly supportive of that. We need to make sure that those dollars come to Los Angeles. We need to ensure that we're, you know, holding, you know, ourselves accountable and making sure that we're prioritizing this segment of the population. The other population that I'm very concerned about are our homeless youth, particularly foster youth. Foster youth is expected to have their entire life figured out by the time they aged out of the system, which is 23 years old. I can't tell you if I know a lot of 23 years old that have it all figured out. So we need to ensure that that group of folks does not end up on the sidewalks, because so many of them don't have anywhere to go. And so women and children, our foster youth are my priority. I want to make sure we're doing everything we can to prevent them from ending up on our streets and doing everything possible to make sure services are being addressed.
Nuri Martinez, who hails from Pacoima, beautiful Pacoima, the new president
you,
of the Los Angeles City Council.
All right.
Madam President, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Huge pieces of rotting, moldy fruit. Doesn't exactly scream fine art, never mind that super expensive banana duct taped to the wall. But a new exhibition by artist Kathleen Ryan at the downtown Francois Gabale Gallery shows you that if you take a closer look at some bad fruit, you might find something beautiful. And here to tell us about it is our art insider, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, who is editor-in-chief of the Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, welcome.
Hey, Steve.
So we are talking about actual moldy fruit here?
No. So you walk into the gallery, and what it appears to be is an oversized bunch of grapes that looks as if it's rotting and moldy. Looks as if. We'll get to this. So then in the next room, again, super oversized, as if a watermelon has just been smashed on the gallery floor. So there's bits of it kind of scattered across the gallery. Again, bits of mold growing. But then if you look closer, you kind of uncover that there's a really interesting materiality to these works.
Describe some of these pieces. See, all right, you mentioned grapes. It looks like the grapes are rotting.
Yeah, so these works start as carved foam that the artist creates these grape-like or watermelon-like forms. And then she meticulously, one by one, with a team of assistants, covers the entire surface with beads and semi-precious stones. So the entire surface is totally covered And she's using those to create these mold-like colors.
So purple beads for grapes,
so
red
for instance,
beads for watermelon.
Yeah, there's a really cool moment on the grape piece where she sourced these kind of shriveling-looking rocks, and it looks like a shriveled grape skin. And then she transitions to yellow and to white and to green, and she kind of follows these mold patterns as they would appear on the surface of a rotting fruit.
I remember art class, like back in you know, junior high school, where it was like pointillism. You know, you would see, you would dot,
yeah.
But then when you expand out, right, you widen the view, it's like, oh, it works.
Right. So from far away, they're super believable as giant rotting fruit, but then it has that kind of aha moment as you get close. And the surfaces also almost look like landscapes. Some of them almost like a lunar landscape or something. Like they have these kind of falls, like hills and mountains.
Did she actually use rotting fruit as like inspiration? Did she, you know, like somebody, like you have a model in front of you
exactly.
as you're painting.
Yeah. So for this grape piece, she had a bunch of grapes that she let sit in her studio for 10 months to observe the kind of decay process.
10 months, grapes, right?
Yeah.
I would think ants.
Yeah.
I would think
probably
flies.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. And I heard, yeah, flies kind of congregate around those fruits that she lets to rot. And in the pieces in the gallery, she sourced these kind of metal figurine type things that she places on the watermelon piece. So she's kind of mimicking that process of kind of animals coming to root around in rotting fruit.
But in essence, these things are actually quite beautiful, these tiny things that make up the art.
Absolutely. I mean, and expensive. I mean, these are sourced stones, crystals. I mean, things that are quite expensive to mimic a rotting, what culture kind of thinks is ugly or garbage state of fruit. And this goes back to art history. I mean, fruit is such a perennial subject in art. And we go to still life paintings, and there's a thing called Vanitas paintings where people would pair something like fruit or a flower with a skull. And it was meant to really talk about the mortality and kind of ephemera of life.
Is that what she's trying to do here?
I think to a degree, yes. Reference that kind of history in art. But also, I mean, look at our economy today and the wealth gap and the housing crisis and the 1%. I mean, there's such a division. And so I think that pairing of kind of opulence and decay is a really potent combination that kind of points to our socio-political environment at the moment.
It's titled Bad Fruit.
Yes. Yes.
Is she trying to tell us that these pieces are just plain bad fruit?
To me, this is where we get into a bit of a gendered conversation. When I hear bad fruit, I think of the phrase bad girl, which is a sort of sexualized and patronizing term. Kathleen Ryan is also a sculptor, like a capital S sculptor, which there aren't a ton of female. I mean, there are, but it's a field that's primarily dominated by men. So the fact that she's making these sculptures and using these kind of terms and things that might be a bit sexualized or talk about femininity. So you think about bad fruit, something that was ripe, you're about to eat it and enjoy it, and the minute it goes bad, you toss it away. And I think that parallels how women, you know, are really valued for their youth and beauty and fertility in our culture, and plays into beauty standards that women have to deal with.
So there's a psychological aspect to this as well.
To me, and that's my Lindsay read, but yeah, definitely I think she uses a lot of these kind of gendered topics in the work.
Well, Kathleen Ryan's Bad Fruit is at the Francois Gabali Gallery, downtown Los Angeles, through almost the end of March, March 29th. Lindsay Preston Zappas, our art insider and editor-chief at Carla, Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, Black Republicans. In the era of pigeonhole politics, meet some African-Americans who are bucking political stereotypes. You can catch us online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast there. Share your thoughts with us there as well, kcrw.com/greaterLA. You can also, when you share your thoughts, go to kcrw.com/askgreaterLA. If you have a question for us, maybe a show that you've heard, talk to us. We'd love to hear from you. Jenna Cagle, Danielle Chiriguayo, Sonia Geis, Amy Toff, Phil Richards, Mike Stark, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordall make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great day.